May it please the court. My name is Thad Geyer, and I am here for the appellants, John Munsell, Montana Quality Foods, and the American Association of Meat Processors. I agree with the position of the government that although the district judge only dealt with the exhaustion issue, and to some extent the Bivens issue, that before the court can adjudicate the exhaustion issue, the court has to determine its jurisdiction. And by that general proposition, the agency invokes the standing and mootness issues that constitutes the bulk of the argument that it has made. And of course, the agency did below.
So you also think that exhaustion is not jurisdictional?
Oh, I completely agree. Exhaustion is not jurisdictional. The Supreme Court has recently made that clear.
But I don't see the word jurisdiction in the Supreme Court's opinion at all. All it says is that it doesn't have to. You don't have to plead exhaustion in the original complaint in that prison case. But I don't think the word jurisdiction appears anywhere in the Supreme Court's opinion.
And that may well be. I guess I don't have sufficient recall to be able to contradict that position. But the Supreme Court's treatment of it as saying, well, this really is just an affirmative defense. I suppose one may argue jurisdiction as an affirmative defense, but I doubt that it would be treated by the Supreme Court in that fashion. But at any rate, I do agree with the agency that exhaustion is not jurisdictional. So the where we stand then on the jurisdiction is that the court has to cannot remain unconvinced of its own jurisdiction, I believe is the way the jurisprudence of this court puts it, and has to make some review of the standing and mootness issues, but is clearly in the disadvantaged position of not having any record from the trial court below, because despite the agency
let me hone you in, I think, to what bothers me in any event. Mr. Munsell and the company are no longer in the business that is subject to the agency regulation.
Munsell and company are no longer a regulated entity, his business is still there.
They're no longer in the business subject to the agency's regulation.
Correct.
All right. Normally, one would think that in that sort, and I'm leaving the association out for now, one would think that that case is moot unless he's raised the claim, or they've raised the claim, looking forward, on which they would have standing to remain in court. And I can't see anything that would allow them to raise a claim looking forward on which they'd have standing. So the case is moot. No?
Well, no, of course I disagree, Your Honor.
What relief can they get?
Well, the relief that Munsell can get is the declaratory and injunctive relief. If the declaratory and injunctive relief basically, if the court were to agree that the agency has to do this trace back for the small plants on
but
the
But he's in no different position than someone on the street who walks in and says, I think the agency has a policy which I find disturbing, and I want declaratory relief because in some point in my life, when I'm an older adult, I'm going to go into meat processing.
And I have to believe there are many people out there with that intent. However, Mr. Munsell is a person who's able to demonstrate through a factual background as well as through his affidavits his continuing involvement.
His continuing interest. He's not involved anymore. He's out of business. Unless you're explain to me how he is now within the compass of the agency.
He's not.
He's not.
He's,
so
he is not directly.
The relief will not give him a remedy of any sort that he can use, other than to say, now I feel satisfied. Well, there may be people on the streets who would like to come in and say, I really want to feel satisfied and have the government stop doing X.
Well, but Munsell is still works with Montana Quality Foods. He's true, he's not licensed with them. And still works with the local association as well as the American Association. He's heavily involved in the meat business and in what, how the regulations apply to small plants, although it is true he himself is no longer a regulated entity. He was regulated out of a family business that had been in his family for generations, as he sets forth in his affidavit, and fully intends, wants to return to becoming a licensed entity, but the retaliation that drove him out has to be remedied first.
Do you think it's enough to say, I was in the regulated arena, I was so offended by what was going on, I left, I'm out of it completely now, I concede. But if you can clean this up in court, I would think about coming back in.
I argue that it's enough. You asked me whether I think it's enough.
No. Go ahead.
Well, I was so fearful of exactly what you're saying that the American Association of Meat Processors was brought in on the first amended complaint to kind of bolster where we were on the standing. I agree. It is a difficult question for us, and it is, but it's no different than it is for any other a plaintiff who has been had his rights violated. Then the defendant fixes its practice, but it's precisely why the Supreme Court says we just simply can't leave it at that. Because
actually, that's not what the Supreme Court says. There are a line of cases, starting with the DeFunis case, which was an affirmative action case, where someone wanted to get into law school, got a restraining order initially, put him in law school. By the time the case got to the Supreme Court, he had graduated. And the court said it was moot, notwithstanding that this person would have liked to have had a declaratory order saying that what this school is doing with respect to affirmative action is unlawful. He no longer had an interest. He had no longer had standing. There was no class there to support the order. He had nothing going forward that would give him standing to seek this. And the court said it's moot.
Well, but there are other cases by the Supreme Court as well, and obviously the Supreme Court jurisprudence changes and evolves over time.
No, in this area it really has not. It's totally consistent.
Well,
because you had a super tire case decided the same year as DeFunis, and the circumstances were slightly different, so it wasn't moot because the party offended, the employer who was fighting with a labor union, said, I'm still in business. And they may strike against me again, and I want this state law that's supporting them knocked out. The Supreme Court said that's not moot because the claimant is still in business and could be affected in the future. Munsell is not in business anymore. He can't be affected by the agency in the future.
I'm not sure where the idea that he was driven out by this process comes from. It seems that it took him 3 years more before he left the industry after these events occurred, right?
I'm very sorry. I wasn't able to hear.
He left the industry 3 years after the events in suit, correct?
Yes.
No reason to infer that he was driven out by this regulatory.
Well, yes. The progression, as pleaded in the complaint, is that the retaliatory regulatory events against him started on January 3rd, 2002, but over the next, I believe, 20 months, he was going through this process in which the agency ultimately required him to revise his corrective action plan.
When did he leave the industry?
He left the industry in 2005. He left the.
So that's 2 years after.
March of 2005.
2 years after the 20 months was run.
But after he had commenced the lawsuit. So I would just. And I've cited the case in my brief, Your Honor, but the case
the bankruptcy
where,
case?
The case where the Supreme Court was confronted with the woman who had been institutionalized, and she filed a suit challenging that institutionalization. And what the agency then did was transferred her out of that institution into community housing. And the Supreme Court said that we have to have a capable of repetition yet
right.
evading of you, even with respect
yes,
to
because looking to forward, does she still has the potential risk of the government acting against her in a way that she would find offensive, right?
Absolutely.
Munsell's not in that position. He's no longer in a category where he can argue that, I'm not regulated anymore. If he comes back in, it's a different case.
But the, but he desires to come back in.
When he filed this suit, did he say, is there anything in the complaint suggesting that he was, might be the victim of a future retaliation?
My argument would be yes, just that if we construe complaints as facts that are pleaded and facts that are reasonably inferred, I believe the answer to that is yes.
There's something in there that you're basing that on?
Well, yes, where he's saying I'm continually retaliated against. I have Congress all after these people. They won't change their regulations. It's simply never going to change.
The change the regulations is a different issue. That's not the First Amendment issue, right?
You're not challenging. That's not the First Amendment.
Right. So we're still on the First Amendment.
That's the declaratory injunction.
Right. Has he claimed that it is likely that he will be retaliated against in the future in a different event for his First Amendment request that the Agriculture Department investigate upstream?
Again, using the same standard, fair inference from the complaint. He has, and in his declaration, he specifically says that I would like to re-enter the industry, but only if the retaliation were going to end against me. I think the fair inference there is.
With respect to the other members of the association, right, have any of them been retaliated against before for their First Amendment claims?
There's nothing in the record before you that addresses
and
that.
And nothing that addresses whether they're likely to be retaliated in the future.
Well, except for the declaration from the AAMP director, who specifically says, we small processors essentially live in fear of the FDA. If you raise concerns against them, expect retaliatory regulatory effects. That's specifically stated.
What is it that were you done, Eric?
Yes.
What is it the association is claiming is offensive about the existing regulations?
That the existing regulations allow punitive action against a small meat processor based on contaminated meat received from the nation's five giant processors.
It doesn't say that, but you're suggesting that by reference, if we look at how their treatment of Munsell, that's likely what will happen? Is
yes.
That the basis of their attack on the regulations?
That is the basis of their attack.
Not that anything in the words of the regulation are impermissible, but it's just the way the agency will enforce it.
Well, there's nothing as bluntly as that in the regulations that said we don't do traceback.
No, I'm not, it's not a trick question. I'm just trying to make sure I understand what you're saying. There are regulations. You're not saying that section anything in those regulations is unlawful, impermissible, arbitrary, and capricious. Rather, you're saying that those lawful regulations, when enforced, become a problem for the association because the enforcement is heavy-handed.
Yes, it's an applied challenge rather than a facial challenge.
Okay.
I'm long out of time. So.
Did you have any further questions? No. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Elisa Klein for the defendants. Just to clarify the dates before going into the legal issues, the last enforcement action identified in the complaint was July 2002, and the plaintiffs went out of business in August 2005, so it was a three-year gap. Of course, for prospective relief, for injunctive relief, the Supreme Court has long required imminent threat of concrete injury. And you know, the easiest answer is that plaintiff is out of business. There's no such imminent threat. The Bivens claim fails for related reasons. Congress set up a scheme under which if you had meat inspectors taking enforcement actions, while there were still live claims for ongoing relief, the plant would challenge them with the agency. There are informal and formal ways to do that, and then go to court for judicial review.
Well,
reviews based on an administrative record.
Can we hold off about that? Just on that, you only get judicial review under the statute if there's a determination by the secretary, after which there's an opportunity for a hearing, that the recipient is unfit to engage in any business, right?
No, Your Honor, any final agency action would be subject...
Oh, you mean under the APA?
Under the APA, exactly.
So how is it, so is your view that in any case in which an agency's action can be reviewed by the APA, there can't be a Bivens action?
Our view is that certainly whereas here you have the paradigmatic agency action that's subject to judicial review...
But all, that's all. All well, agency actions
that would be...
All final
well,
agency actions.
All final agency actions. Uh-huh. But, of course, here there's more. I mean, this case would fail at the first step of the Wilkie analysis.
Well, I want to start with the first step. The Wilkie analysis says, doesn't decide that APA review is enough. In fact, it says there's a good argument that it's not. And it compares it to all the other cases in which it stopped at the first step, where there was a comprehensive scheme with lots of different ways to attack what was being done. In this case, there's nothing but the APA and an extremely vaguely worded internal regulation.
Your Honor, with respect, I disagree with the description of the Wilkie analysis.
You do?
The problem in Wilkie, and this is at page 2600, was that Mr. Robbins had what the court, I'm quoting now, had a patchwork, an assemblage of state and federal administrative and judicial benches applying regulations and statutes and common law rules. When it dealt with what it called the conventional agency action, it said, of course, that's subject to review under the APA. And I agree the court didn't decide anything on that basis.
Well, just my understanding. So, yes, they actually had a bit more in Wilkie than they have here. But the court pointed out that administrative review was available, subject to ultimate judicial review under the APA. And then the court says that this state of the law does not plainly answer no to the first question, right?
The APA was only a subset of the injuries Mr. Robbins was complaining about. Uh-huh. He had, over a seven-year period, a whole variety set out by the court of different types of complaints, criminal charges, trespass, invasion of privacy,
none of them could have been actually resolved by the APA.
Exactly. Oh, there were, I think, three types of actions of which he complained that could have been resolved under the APA.
Well, there's a lot of informal agency action here that's not final agency action under the APA, right?
It's all classic enforcement of the Federal Meat Inspection Act.
Yes, so there wouldn't be final agency action that could be reviewed under the APA.
There would be here. There was a suspension.
But then the suspension was suspended.
Yeah. Well, first, even held in abeyance, the suspension could have been challenged.
I want to be clear then. The government's position is, and for future cases, that where it's held in abeyance, you can get APA review?
Yes, and let me, first, you can clearly get administrative review.
Oh, yeah, fine. I don't know whether that's right or not, but I'm interested in the judicial review.
So held in abeyance is final. For agents for purposes of judicial review?
It may depend how the case arises. Certainly, there is a way to challenge the conditions on which a plan is being required to operate. So if effectively FSIS is saying you will be suspended unless you keep doing these things, and there's an argument that the requirements are not justified either as a matter of law or fact, that can be presented in court. Here, this was a very different scenario because that argument wasn't made to the agency. It was more of a negotiation. Ultimately, there was a plan proposed by the plant. And the last word from the agency, and this is now back July 22, 2002, was our understanding is that your concerns have been satisfactorily addressed.
But he didn't agree to that.
Yeah, that's the agency's
statement.
But as the district court explained.
He continued to complain.
No, that was, if you look at the sequence, and this is the district court's point, that was the very last, even in his declaration, that is the last communication from the agency, July 22, 2002.
No, from the agency, that's right. But his contention is that he continued to complain and they continued to ignore him.
If the court looks at his declaration, all of the complaints preceded that. They were in February of 2002 or March of 2002.
No, I think if you look at the record, we can both go back and look. I think you'll see the record indicates that he continued to complain after that July. He never acceded to that. He never said, oh, okay, I agree. He continued to complain.
Well, I mean, again, you know, I would encourage the court to go back over his declaration.
So you really believe that the record indicates that post-July 22 there was not a single communication from Munsell to any agency official about his concerns about these regulations?
There's nothing in the record until this lawsuit, and then...
What about his contacts with members of Congress?
That preceded. The July 22nd letter was written from the FSIS deputy administrator to the members of Congress, noting that, you know, there had been a series of meetings and saying, It's our understanding.
I'm asking, does the record show that he had any further contact with his representatives after that letter?
No, Your Honor. That's why Judge Lambert said, although, you know, plaintiff apparently chafed under this suspension, he didn't challenge it administratively.
Judge Lambert didn't say anything about post-July 22.
Well, that's the reason he said that.
Well, no, we can't attribute any reason. He didn't say anything about it.
Well, the record was before the court.
When we looked at it, that's exactly what you see. Well, it looks like, my recollection is wrong, I think there was some communications post-July 22. One of the problems here is I don't know what the alleged exhaustion was supposed to be. The agency never said, well, here, I don't know what the procedure is, and when you read the statute and regs, it's almost impossible to figure out what it would be. But in any event, he kept complaining. But let me ask you another question, please. What are you arguing about retaliation? Say an existing meat processor, and think of the worst case. I don't want to waste time giving you a hypothetical, but any reasonable person would say this is really retaliation of the worst sort. You're saying the only recourse that person has is an APA claim?
And
maligning him, defaming him, destroying things, taking licenses away. I mean, whatever. Make it as bad as you can imagine. You're saying, and it's an existing meat processor. And there's no question that what's happening is the government agents have been told by the highest person in Washington, get this guy. And they proceed to do it.
Wilkie,
and APA is their claim?
Wilkie is the worst case. The court of
appeals. No, stay with mine, okay?
Well, no, but I'm saying that was the death by a thousand cuts case. That's explicitly what the Supreme Court called it. 7 years of intimidation and harassment.
Wilkie expressly distinguishes
right.
Retaliation for First Amendment speech from what happened in that case. In fact, the case says, unlike punishing someone for speaking out against the government, trying to induce someone to grant an easement for public use is a perfectly legitimate purpose. So I think that with respect, at least to the, I don't know whether you're, it's a little unclear to me whether you're discussing Bivens when you were just having a colloquy with Judge Edwards, but on the Bivens question,
right.
Wilkie distinguishes between the two. Is that right? And in this case, he has a First Amendment claim, not a you retaliated by making me make an easement claim.
But Wilkie, I agree, Wilkie was dealing with a different line drawing problem. But if you step back a bit, the concern in Wilkie, and again, this is the language of the Supreme Court, yeah. was that creating a Bivens remedy
yeah.
that would be worse than the disease.
Yeah, and that and
the
was because...
And, well, the reason is because the difficulty of line drawing meant that you would end up inhibiting legitimate enforcement action.
By the meat inspectors, right?
Well, that is absolutely the concern.
And that's what your argument is here.
Yes, the concern right. here, and so it's
and
not exactly...
And they're very vulnerable to being sued by people who don't like what they're doing.
Yes, because the statute right. gives them a right to be in there every day,
yeah.
7 days a week.
And as a representative of the United States, do you think they're more vulnerable than your fellow prosecutors are?
The prosecutors are generally immune.
Well, not when they're acting outside of the courtroom or the grand jury room. Are they more? And there is a Bivens action available against prosecutors for First Amendment violations, right?
Not that the Supreme Court has recognized Bivens remedies in three cases. We've got the FBI warrantless arrest and
yeah.
search.
Yeah.
Davis and Passman, which yeah. was a sex discrimination claim against a member of Congress, because at that point there was no Title VII remedy or equivalent against
yeah.
Congress.
Yeah.
And then Carlson was a yeah. prisoner suit, you know,
yeah.
a
but we're forgetting
deliberate indifference.
We're forgetting Hartman, aren't we?
Well, Hartman was, by the Supreme Court,
yes.
you know, was reversed for lack of a cause of action.
No, but in Hartman versus Moore, this which involves... Well, that's a different issue. But with respect to Hartman versus Moore, which is the case which started against a prosecutor and postal inspectors but ended against the postal inspectors, the court said, when the vengeful officer is federal, he is subject to an action for damages on the authority of Bivens. Now, there was an additional issue in that case, which is what was the threshold for the cause of action. But the court held that you have a Bivens action for retaliating against somebody under the First Amendment. The court says official reprisal for protected speech offends the Constitution. We have held that retaliation is subject to recovery as the but-for cause of official action offending the Constitution.
Well, Again, first, there's no general First Amendment Bivens claim. Bush versus Lucas was a First Amendment claim that was precluded.
Yes, but that was because there was a comprehensive statute which provided the employee in that case with us with a remedy.
Civil service.
No, but Wilkie asks two questions. First, is there a remedy?
Yes.
Here, clearly there is.
No, but the Supreme Court did not say that the APA was enough. Is there any case in which the Supreme Court has ever said that the APA is a sufficiently comprehensive remedy?
No case has gone to the Supreme Court. Right. The courts of appeals that have addressed it, the Eighth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, right, along with some indication that Congress's
right.
failure
to the Supreme Court's never said that the AP, the Supreme Court cases about comprehensive relief and our own cases about comprehensive relief are all about things like Merit System Protection Board, Civil Service Act, things like that, right?
Well, again, this court has never, it's an open question in the circuit. We're not claiming it's been resolved by this circuit or by the Supreme Court.
Right.
But under the principles set out by the Supreme Court, and again, in Wilkie, the two questions. First, was there a remedy? And the reason the court didn't rely on the APA there was because the APA only covered a subset of his grievances. There was damage to his property, to a lodge. There were criminal charges. And what Justice Souter said was this, you know, patchwork doesn't create any inference. You know, it doesn't give him a strong claim to new remedies, nor does it create an inference against. Therefore, we go to step two. And what the court says was Congress is in a far better position than a court to evaluate the impact of a new species of litigation against those who act on the public's behalf, and Congress can tailor a remedy to lessen the risk of raising a tide of suits.
I got that part. I want you to go to the point where they distinguish punishing somebody for First Amendment expression, where the court says this is not that case.
The reason they're they're making that distinction is because of the issue of creating a workable cause of action.
Right.
We have the same problem here, though not for the same reason. But the problem here, as in Wilkie, is how could a court fashion a remedy that's not going to chill the enforcement that Congress was at pains to protect in the Federal Meat Inspection
Act? Isn't that what happened in Hartman? I don't understand. In Hartman, there was an issue about what the first question was, is there a Bivens action against the postal inspectors for First Amendment retaliation? The court said yes. Then the court asked the question you're asking, which was, well, how do we protect them enough? Qualified immunity is a possibility, but in that case, there was a threshold. You had to prove no probable cause. Why isn't
that? The Supreme Court did not consider any special factors argument in Hartman. The Supreme
right.
Court just went right into the question of is there a claim and held no, that the absence of probable cause has to be alleged and proven. It's not.
That's part of the cause of action.
But I mean, there was no argument in Hartman in the Supreme Court. I didn't believe there was one in this court, but perhaps I was mistaken. But certainly the Supreme Court did not address any special factors argument.
Yeah, that's right. They assumed that there was a cause of action under Bivens, right?
Well, I mean, the government was arguing and argued successfully that there was no cause of action. It's not that those issues don't have to be addressed in one order or another. But again, Nebraska Beef held that there is no.
That's an Eighth Circuit case.
Eighth Circuit. No,
that's correct. And we're saying that the reasoning is correct and should be followed here. Again, the Federal Meat Inspection Act puts meat inspectors on the ground every day with a big range of enforcement actions. It can slow the production lines. It can say throw out that carcass. It can say your acid wash doesn't have a high enough pH level. And so there is an enormous potential.
That's true for almost all federal enforcers. The postal inspectors can put you out of business. Prosecutors can put you in jail. I mean, I can see you making, if we accept your argument, you will be making the same argument with respect to any other kind of agency enforcement.
Your Honor is probably correct, and I should say the Supreme Court has not extended Bivens, you know, since 1980, and we do not believe, and no, we're not aware of any court allowing actions to go forward of the type Your Honor describes.
Is it any part of your argument that the express statutory exhaustion requirement counsels against a Bivens remedy?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And the Eighth Circuit relied on that as
but
well.
It's something of a limiting feature.
Exactly. And I'm trying to offer a number of limiting features because I anticipated the concern. This case in our view, falls on the easy side of the line, and the opinion can be written narrowly because you have both the availability of judicial review, the mandatory, you know, congressional mandatory exhaustion, plus particular concerns reflected in part in the anti-gratuity.
So on
provision.
That easy side of the line, let me suggest another easy solution, even easier than the one you're suggesting, which is we don't have to decide whether there's a Bivens action. Because even if there is a Bivens action, in this case, unlike other Bivens cases, Congress has made clear that there's an exhaustion requirement. There is a statutory exhaustion requirement. So an element of the cause of action, if there were one under Bivens, would be exhaustion. I don't see why we have to decide that there's no Bivens action because there's an exhaustion requirement. Why isn't the appropriate resolution that if there is a Bivens action,
it hasn't been exhausted?
It's true, but it leaves the agency in a bit of a practical quandary. Does this mean now there will be future proceedings before the agency on a non-existing claim?
Judging the case before it's been presented.
You have the same problem. If it's a cause of action issue and not a jurisdiction issue, you have this problem no matter what. And the question is, what do you have in the pleadings in this case? In this case, you actually have pleadings, right? You had affidavits filed, right?
Because it was treated as jurisdictional, Mr. Mansell was permitted to file an affidavit.
And we
with
have
13
many
exhibits.
Cases in which we've said that, A, we can convert a jurisdictional issue into a 12B6 issue. And we also have cases that say that once there are affidavits, we can convert 12B6 into summary judgment. So I don't see why it matters to the government with respect to this issue, the one you're talking about, whether this is regarded as, is there a cause of action at all? No, because of the exhaustion statute. Or is there a cause of action, but if there is one, it's limited by the exhaustion statute? What's the difference?
I should agree, this court has discretion and can affirm on exhaustion as essentially summary judgment on an affirmative defense. And we said that in our brief. From Dr. Clark's perspective, there's a world of difference as to, do I have a claim against me before the agency that I now have to defend? You know, we're now, you know, like 5 years after the underlying action.
It might depend upon what he does 5 years from now.
What do you mean before the agency? Yeah. I'm not following it.
Well, perhaps I'm misunderstanding. If it's dismissed on exhaustion,
right,
that suggests
it's a failure of
the
cause of action. For failure of any cause. It's not jurisdictional. For failure of any cause of action.
Does that mean there will be, you know, tomorrow, if the court issued a decision, proceedings before the agency on a Bivens claim?
Doesn't the regulation have a time for
exhaustion? No, Your Honor, Congress did not envision agencies or courts deciding long moot claims.
No, the regulation, the internal regulation.
No, Your Honor, there's not, because, again, in the normal situation, the way Congress anticipated, there's an incentive for the plant to go right to the agency because it's being injured by a suspension.
What was the question you just asked rhetorically? Does this mean the court what? What did you say?
Well, the concern is if it's dismissed on exhaustion grounds, does that mean that the agency, you know, that then Mr. Mansell could then go to the agency in the future, you know, come and say,
Mr. Mansell's not in the business now. So that's fairly simple. There's nothing he can bring now.
Not for prospective relief, but if...
And the agency, I assume, could say in an administrative procedure, if one was initiated by someone who was being regulated, could say this is untimely. And
how can somebody not in the business appeal a decision about somebody who is in the business? How can that be done in this case, in any case?
I understood the court to be saying it would assume there's a damages remedy. So backward looking.
No, we would say we don't have to deal with it here.
Because assuming there is, it wasn't exhausted.
It wasn't exhausted.
Well,
we're
certainly not objecting to affirming.
You'd like to win all the cases.
We'd like to win. But again, I just want to make clear that this shouldn't be the start of an agency process that's looking back to 2002 to decide whether there was retaliation. That's our concern.
Well, I mean, the alternative would be to say, where there's retaliation offending the First Amendment, don't worry about the agency, come directly into court. Is that the one you prefer?
No, of course.
I don't think so.
No, that's right. But, of course, our view is that the Eighth Circuit was exactly right, and Wilkie makes it even more clear that the court should not be creating a cause of action that can inhibit enforcement activity.
Let me ask you one thing. Your time is running over. So what is your view on the association?
There is no challenge to any rule currently in effect. The amended complaint didn't even cite the directive that was revised before the original complaint was filed. So, I mean, an association is free to challenge the rule.
Let me just assume that, in fact, I can read the complaint and assume that the association is one of the plaintiffs before us, read the complaint to say they are objecting to the agency's regulations.
Well, then there's a separate regulatory procedure to challenge rules before the agency, and that hasn't been invoked here. So that would fail.
You're just falling back on exhaustion.
Well, we don't believe there is any challenge to a rule because they don't even cite the...
I want you to assume that there is.
Assuming, I can just imagine, if there's a rule the association wants to challenge, then they, under a different regulatory provision that we cited, bring the challenge to the official who issued the rule, and after action by the agency can, you know, bring the challenge to court. That's just a facial challenge to a rule. We don't see anything like that here.
These rules were issued a while ago, right?
There was a directive, the Directive 10,010.1, that was issued a long time ago, was in place in 2002, was rewritten in its entirety in March 2004. The original complaint wasn't filed till October 2004, and doesn't even cite the revision.
But if it were a rule, it would be would have been within the time for filing a... I mean, I'm a little confused about why this is done this way. Normally you can't, am I wrong about this? Normally you can't, I don't know what the agriculture statute for judicial review of rulemaking says. Normally there's a window in which you can challenge a rule. If you wait too long, you can only challenge it when it's applied to you.
Right? You can always file a petition.
Or you can file a petition for rulemaking.
Right.
None of these things happened here.
They could file a petition to amend or repeal a rule, and after an agency decision on that petition,
right,
could seek judicial review.
And
that
hasn't where we are. That would be where we were. That's what I assume you thought would have to occur at this stage. That is, it's too late to challenge the rule. It wasn't challenged as applied to you, so all you can do is petition for rulemaking.
Exactly.
And this case itself is not, your position isn't even a rule, it's a policy, so it's like Cobell or it's like Utah or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. You're saying, wait, let me just hear, the last part, you're saying it wouldn't be reviewable because it's a policy statement?
No, we're saying the type of relief they're seeking here isn't properly regarded as a challenge to a rule. It's saying...
No, I thought Judge Garland was taking you further. If there was a challenge done legitimately, were you also saying you would then advance the argument it's a challenge to a policy statement and therefore not reviewable?
It would depend what the challenge was. We're not saying there can't be any challenge.
The challenge would be to this thing that is now in place.
Your Honor, the thing is, you know, 100 pages. It depends what they're arguing.
We haven't seen it, so I'm trying to understand.
It's in the record.
I know, but okay. I'm trying to understand your argument. Are you making the argument that this is a policy statement and therefore it wouldn't be reviewable in any event?
No, Your Honor.
Oh, then I misunderstood.
Yeah, I thought
you cited Cobell, right, and the Utah case. Isn't this is a program, and you can't challenge the sort of overall enforcement program? Am I wrong, or am I?
It's because of the relief.
I'm projecting into you my
thoughts. Well, the relief they're seeking in the complaint, just to read an example, their injunctive relief. To enjoin enforcement action based on an administrative determined that a plant's HACCP plan is inadequate if said finding is based in whole or in part on the small plant's failure to sample or test for E. coli at its expense incoming beef products already bearing USD approval my point is that this is not a challenge to a rule.
Right. And on page 20 of your brief, which gave me this idea, it said,
yes,
these claims do not ask a court to resolve a controversy arising out of a discrete agency action or to issue the type of relief available under the APA. And then quoting from Cobell, because an ongoing program or policy is not in itself final agency action under the APA, court's jurisdiction does not extend to reviewing generalized complaints against agency behavior.
Correct.
That is I'm not asking you whether it's right or not. Obviously,
that's right.
This is your argument.
But it arises out of the relief they're seeking in the complaint, which is prospective and
sort of like a ripeness argument in a
right? Yeah, but you didn't argue either one. I mean, those are really very distinct arguments. It's unripe, or, so leave it alone. If they have something later on, they can come back. Or, Your Honor, this is a policy statement, and the case law is absolutely clear that if all you have is a policy statement, there's no review until we apply it. You didn't argue either one of those things.
We've argued that there needs to be final agency.
Yeah,
okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank
you.
McGuire, take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel greatly oversimplified, to say the least, what the dispute is here regarding this policy, which is FSA. FSIS Directive 10,010. And while it's certainly her right to mimic the language of her, the affidavits from the from agency representative characterizing the changes in a single revision of the exact same policy with the exact same number as a complete revamping, is we went to pains in the district court and in presenting that record here to you that there was very little change, even alleged by the government as to the policy. We narrowed it down to the four changes that they really seem to address in comparing the policy.
Mr. Guy, the problem for you is, seems to me, that with respect to the association now, because I think there are different problems with respect to oneself, assuming what you just said is absolutely correct and there is a rule, it would appear, at least on the surface, that it's unripe, the challenge is unripe for the rest of the association members.
Well, I don't,
assuming you're correct, how is it right? I mean, I don't even know what it is we would be doing.
Well, because the FSIS directive, the part that Munsell is challenging and that all of his, the declaratory injunctive relief that the...
No, I want you to focus on the remaining association members who we know are alive and doing business and are subject to agency regulation. And so I'm suggesting to you whatever claims they might have about the existing regulations are not ripe for court consideration.
And I disagree only because...
No, but tell me why.
Because the FSIS directive 10,010, even in its revision, still will allow
for bad practices.
It will allow for
bad practices.
It will allow for small plants to have enforcement action and be set out of business because they receive contaminated meat from a large plant.
This is what we went through before. Not because the regulation itself explicitly says that, but you're just fearful of what inspectors might do.
Yes, that if they follow what the directive seems to be.
That's precisely what ripeness sweeps away. We have no idea what that might be, and if and when it happens, then you have a claim to pursue on behalf of the remaining association members, right?
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Geyer. Ms. Klein, thank you. The case is submitted.